ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, hello and happy Friday. Selena Green with you today. Let's talk wild dogs today. Specifically, how new Victorian laws around wild dog control are impacting farmers along the South Australian-Victorian border. What is the state government doing about it? And you'll hear from a Western Victorian farmer who's frustrated by a lack of options to protect his sheep.
It's just the random nature of it. So you come up, you go out to check the stock, and it's just that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach that you don't actually know what you're going to discover. And, of course, over this time, it's happening quite regularly. So, you know, it's just a matter of time before we see it happen again.
Are you noticing any more wild dogs or attacks on stock around the border area? Let me know today. My talkback number 1300 222 891, or the text line is 0467 922 891. Also coming up, why it's time to be on top of your worm control plan, because unseasonal weather has seen some worm cases spread to areas not usually affected. First today, the South Australian government has raised urgent concerns that they have with the Victorian government's changes to wild dog management. Currently along the shared border, the two states' plans are at odds. Primary Industries Minister Claire Scriven says she'll be seeking a reversal of the decision in Victoria.
Yeah, so we're really disappointed with the decision by Victoria to lift the non-protection order on wild dogs in northwestern Victoria. So until now, farmers and others have been able to destroy dogs under certain circumstances, wild dogs, and that's really important to protect livestock. And there's lots of examples of where wild dogs have attacked particularly newborn lambs, which is problematic from an economic point of view, but also it's pretty distressing to see. And the impact of wild dogs also on the environment, particularly vulnerable species, is important as well. So we think that here in South Australia we've had the balance right. There's been the availability, and there still is in South Australia, of destroying wild dogs to protect livestock. But in Victoria now, in northwest Victoria, they have changed that. So we're really concerned it will have impacts on South Australia, because obviously wild dogs don't recognise a border, and so we're very concerned. I've written to both the Minister for Agriculture and the Minister for Environment in Victoria, and that follows on from a number of other letters and correspondence that I've had over the last probably 4 or 5 months. Now, we were expecting to be involved in the review of wild dog management in Victoria. Back in October, the Minister said that there would be a 12-month review, and we wrote to ask to be part of that. So we are surprised that this decision has come out before the outcome of that review, and that's why I've been communicating our concerns and seeking extra information from Victoria.
Yes, will that extra information also be why they've taken this decision? You know, there has been talk about whether it's wild dogs and dingoes, and will that be part of those discussions?
Yes, so I want to better understand the reasons for the decision, and also get extra information about the exemption process that they have said that they'll be putting in place. So it's really important we have that extra information and have that as soon as possible. So I am hoping to have a meeting with the Minister for Agriculture in the very near future. Our officers have already been in contact, and we've been trying to organise that and get that extra information, and also put very strongly my concerns as the Minister responsible for agriculture here in South Australia, and the concerns of the livestock industry about this decision that Victoria has made.
So Victoria and South Australia's plans very different at the moment, and as you said, we share a border, and wild dogs don't know that there's two different plans on two different sides. Do you think there will be able to be some compatibility where both plans will work for the respective states? Does it need to be a joint plan?
Well, it's very difficult to see how the recent decision can be compatible with South Australia's approach. We think our approach is reasonable and responsible. There are dingoes that are protected on the other side of the dog fence, but we've invested more than $26 million in repair of the dog fence and upgrades to the dog fence over recent years. It's an incredibly important part of protecting our livestock industry. And so that's why I'll be lobbying very hard. At this stage, it's difficult to see how the two can work in unison in any way, which is why I need to get that extra information from the Victorian Government and hopefully put our view in such a way that sees some adjustment to this decision.
And have you heard much from graziers along the border that have livestock and are concerned?
Yes, I have. I've certainly been in contact with Livestock SA about the issue, and they also report, obviously, their members' concerns. But I'm aware, too, that Tadiara Council has had a motion on it, I believe, at their meeting, which would be representative of some of their landowners. And, you know, it's clearly a significant concern. We've had, you know, a lot of work and a lot of effort going into wild dog control and management in South Australia, and to have the risks of a lot of that being undone by this decision by the Victorian Government in regards to Northwest Victoria is of significant concern.
That is the Primary Industries Minister for South Australia, Claire Scriven, speaking with Elsie Adamo. Well, a farmer on the Victorian South Australian border says he's powerless to stop wild dogs from or dingoes from slaughtering his sheep. Alan Bennett, who farms on the edge of the Big Desert north of Kniver in Western Victoria, has had 5 attacks on his sheep in the past month. And he can't do anything about it because the government's wild dog control program ended last month. He's had no luck in applying for authority to control wildlife, despite the government saying it would remain a control option for farmers. He says the now scrapped wild dog control program was working extremely well, and without it, his sheep are being butchered.
Well, about a month ago, we had a quite serious dog attack, and the normal procedure is that you ring the department in Mildura and then they'll get a dogger to come and have a look and set traps to remove the dog. When I rang, they said, oh no, they couldn't do anything, there was a decision pending, and then 2 days later the announcement came that the unprotected status of the wild dogs in a 3-kilometre buffer zone around the Big Desert had been lifted, so we were unable to do any lethal means of control of the wild dogs.
How many sheep have you had killed?
Oh, look, I haven't made a grand tally. The first attack was the worst, which everyone says is the way the dogs operate. We lost 13 directly in that one out of a mob of about 200 ewes, and then when we got them in, there were a lot with wounds, bite marks around their back legs, and some of them subsequently died, which is often the case. And then we've had 4 subsequent attacks since. And our neighbours have had a couple as well. And that was from about the 12th of March, I think.
Have you had dog attacks in the past?
Very, very rarely. Because the management plan has worked so well that if you do see dogs or you have dogs attacked, then you contact the relevant authorities. And yeah, they'll send a trapper out and that problem dog is removed and then the problem doesn't happen. So our losses over the years have been very, very minimal since that. That was brought in about 30 years ago after a lot of lobbying from local farmers and community people.
What's it like to go out, check on your sheep and come across a dog attack and the results of it?
Oh, it's very distressing. So my daughter's the one who mainly managed the sheep, so it's been hard for her. It's been very hard for me too. It's the random nature of it, so we don't know what paddock the dogs will go to next, or you move stock around, well, that just, you know, confuses them, or they go and find another mob. It's just the random nature of it. So you come up, you go out to check the stock, and it's just that sinking feeling in the pit of your stomach that you don't actually know what you're going to discover. And, of course, over this time it's happening quite regularly, so, you know, it's just a matter of time before we see it happen again.
And I spoke recently to a veteran trapper who said that the way they operate, the way that the dogs or dingoes operate, is that they're not even necessarily fussed about killing the sheep, but they're almost eating them alive.
Yep, that's correct. They don't try and kill the sheep. They'll attack a number of the sheep in the mob until they find one that they'll cut out or it'll knock up or it'll flop down, and then they'll just start eating it, and then eventually, of course, that sheep will die. And then a lot of those other sheep that they've bitten, trying to find one that they can get, they'll die as well. And then the other thing about them is they might come back tomorrow and they won't go to that carcass of the one that has died yesterday. They'll go and do the same process again to try and find one to knock up, and then they'll get a meal out of that and then leave the sheep to die, and then wander off again. So, yeah, the nature of it, yeah. So they're not there to kill the sheep, they're just there to eat the sheep.
And now, of course, the government's control program has ended. So, as you said, the past practice of calling the trapper and getting them to deal with the problem, that's not an option for you, Alan. So where does that leave you?
Well, the only thing we've got left now, we've got non-lethal means of control, of course. Well, that's fencing and guarding animals. Well, we're busy. We've done some exclusion fencing. We're busy blocking holes up in boundary fences everywhere, but they're caused by the huge influx of kangaroos and emus we get out of the park as well that come and graze our feed and drink our water. We do have the possibility of applying for an authority to control wildlife, which I've done for a dog, but I've done the lambing the dog, and I've got to call them a dingo in the process. So that's just being so protracted. So that I'm waiting now over 2 weeks for an outcome on that. There have been several department staff come up here and visit on property, and I think basically that's to try and prove that the dogs are actually killing my sheep. So all the onus is on me to prove that. The last attack we had, I was asked to put the dead sheep in a cool room so that they could come up and take DNA swabs to establish it was a wild dog that had killed it or a dingo or whatever, I don't know. And, of course, that was unfeasible for me, so I didn't do it. So it's 2.5 weeks now, and in that time we've had multiple dog attacks. I said to someone the other day, you know, you can't ask the dogs to go on holiday while the department gets organised in how they handle this. So this is the first time this will have happened, this application for an authority to control a dog, and they don't know how to handle it.
And as far as proof, I mean, you've got pictures. I've seen one of them that you've got a sheep with basically its guts hanging out. That's proof enough, isn't it?
Well, I guess they would say that they don't know what that's called, being caused by a wild dog or a dingo or an escaped domestic dog, or I don't know. I don't know their reasoning, but I think it's become that political that they're actually not game to come out and actually give me one, and they're just keeping me in limbo. So they've made the decision that we can't do it. This is supposed to be the process that we follow through, and it's 2.5 weeks, and I still haven't been given an answer on that. And I only put an application in to get one dog, not multiple, just one. I thought, well, we'll just try for one for a start.
So what are you going to do?
Well, we're going to start exclusion fencing as soon as we can, but it's just a Swiss cheese because there's so much boundary that you've got to try and protect, and the dogs can just walk around the edge, or we've got roads, got the Marble Road that goes through our properties, past our properties, we've got other roads that go through, and the dogs use the roads. It's just going to mean that we're going to have to massively alter the management of our properties up here. We do some cropping and mainly sheep, and the implications, we haven't even really got to the bottom of that yet.
That was West Wimmera farmer Alan Bennett, and he was speaking there with Angus Verley and the Victorian Department responsible for administering the Authority to Control Wildlife Permit System. They were contacted for comment. It's 17 minutes past 12.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, livestock producers, you're being warned about the impact of worms, as typically the parasites present in warmer, high rainfall environments. But with unseasonal rains falling in drier parts of the country, worm cases, we're told, have been spread to areas not usually affected. Vet Services team leader for the New South Wales Western Local Land Services, Lou Baskin, says that it's important to be on top of your worm control plan, especially heading into spring lambing and calving.
So worms are parasites, which means they draw sort of nutrition, I guess, from the animal. They're sucking nutrition from the animal. So the animal is eating. They're supposed to be getting that for themselves to grow or to reproduce or to, you know, put on muscle or grow wool, those kinds of things. But actually that resource is being stolen from them by the worms. And so they cause animals to generally sort of not gain weight. But then as the problem gets worse, they can lose weight. They can start getting diarrhea or scours, they can get anemic, so they lose red blood cells. And if the problem gets really, really bad, you actually get animals dying from those worms.
How sort of prevalent is worms at this point, and are you seeing a lot of cases at the moment?
In the western region, it is extremely variable what we see, because there's some places that will never get any worms because the animals are so extensively farmed, you know, they're not really contacting the worm larva because they're moving away from where they're leaving their dung. They've got heaps of space and it's not a problem and it's dry and it's the worms are not thriving in those areas. But In other areas, we see really significant problems. And the idea that, you know, we don't get worms in the West is what really catches people out, because when you have a wet season or wet and warm season and the worm numbers build up, it can really catch people by surprise because they sort of haven't factored management in regarding worms. So what we end up seeing is these situations where worms haven't been managed, and then the problem is so huge that animals are actually dying from it. So, yeah, we have been seeing a few cases, particularly with Barber's poleworm, which are very vicious worm in sheep and goats and will actually kill them.
What are some of the best ways to get on top of maybe a worm outbreak and best treatment options there?
Traditionally, we think about chemical drenching, which is a really, really important tool to be able to use. But the problem we have with that is that the more we use those chemicals, they start to fail because we develop resistance. So we want to find a balance between using the chemical drenches when we need to and testing and managing having a management program to try and reduce the use of those when we don't need to. So definitely if there's a very big problem, you're going to be getting in there with the chemical drenches. But you also want to have that program where you're monitoring for the problem and only using the drenches when you need to. But we were talking about, you know, this preparation for that sort of lambing or calving period. Generally, we do recommend that female animals are given a chemical drench. The pregnant animals are given a chemical drench to prepare them for that period because they've got so much else going on, right? Their bodies are growing a lamb or a calf. They can't really get all the nutrition they need for that. And then they also have this period where they get less resistant to the worms and they can't fight them off. So we want to give them every chance, basically. So that is the time that we actually recommend a chemical drench.
Vet Services team leader for New South Wales Western Local Land Services, Luke Baskind. Sheep and cattle producer from Armidale in northeastern New South Wales, Ben Foster, says that he's noticed the increase in the spread of the Barber's poleworm, noting that producers are finding it particularly difficult to get on top of.
Over the last few years, particularly with two or three La Nina years in a row, we've got areas of Australia that are normally winter rainfall, getting, you know, fairly significant rainfall through the summer, the warmer months, which is the ideal situation for Barber's poleworm. It likes warm and wet conditions. And, yeah, a lot more widespread. Probably even I've noticed a big difference since the 2019 drought, and I guess a lot of sheep moved around from different areas in the country and potentially took parasites with them. And also a huge difference in the last few years in the resistance to drenches. So people are starting to find the parasites a lot harder to control.
And is this worm found in cattle and sheep?
Yeah, look, it is. There is two types of Haemoccus, which is the scientific name. And generally, a lot of people talk sheep and cattle. You've got one for each. But cattle can cycle the sheep one, particularly younger cattle. Calves can, as soon as they get a little bit more age on them, a lot of sort of parasitologists talk that they can actually, you know, not readily establish an infection, and they'll generally boot them out, particularly dry cattle or something with a bit more age on them. But they certainly, young cattle, can cycle them.
Is it pretty hard to sort of get on top of for producers?
It can be. In the last few years, people have really struggled with this because it's with the wet times that we've had, and if we do go into spring again the same, it's just so ideal for the parasite. And Barber's pole can lay a lot of eggs, you know, 5,000 to 10,000 eggs a day a female worm can lay. And they're hatched and up on the grass going, you know, pretty well in 5 to 7 days. They're back there being re-ingested. So the whole thing can just change so fast just with big numbers. And that's when people really struggle to get on top of it. I find a lot of people really struggle if they don't know what drenches are working on their property too. If they've never conducted a fecal egg count reduction test, which is a test where you test all your different drenches to see what's working, I guess you're guessing all the time. And if you are using a drug which is not working very well, you're always leaving a fairly significant egg count in that animal after drenching. And then you might find, you know, you've got an outbreak, you know, 2 weeks later, a week later, you've got major issues.
And I guess, as you mentioned earlier, we're seeing Barber's pole in areas where typically it wouldn't be. I guess, is that going to sort of mean that producers are going to struggle to find what's going to work best for their livestock if it presents in their sheep and cattle?
Absolutely. Yep, surely is. Like southern Queensland, central Queensland in the right times, central west of New South Wales, a lot more problems. Victoria has reported a lot of Barber's pole, South Australia, parts of WA, a bit more seasonal. But it is getting more widespread, there is no doubt about that.
That is sheep and cattle producer from Armidale, New South Wales, Ben Foster, and he was speaking there to Lily McCure. It's 24 minutes past 12. You're on the South Australian Country Hour with Selena Green on this Friday. Let's head to the Weather Bureau, and Simon Timke joins us again today from the Bureau. Hi, Simon.
G'day, Selena.
What's happening weather-wise?
Well, we had the tail end of a cold front move over the south of the state late Thursday and early this morning. So we've seen a bit of cloud associated with that extend right up over the agricultural area, far south of the pastoral districts and the Flinders district, also over the West Coast district there. And there has been a little bit of shower activity in there too, mostly sort of focused about the southern agricultural area, but we have seen isolated fairly light showers push a fair way further inland. Even sort of over inland parts of Eyre Peninsula, we've seen places pick up only a fraction of a millimetre, but as far inland as Yunta too, had 0.4 of a millimetre there. So the showers did actually push a fair way inland, but the totals generally not terribly high. Sort of wettest areas, as I mentioned, about the southern agricultural area, where we've seen a few places pick up the order of sort of 5 to 8 or 9 millimetres or so. But as that fronts continue to move away to the east, we've seen the showers become very isolated now and fairly light. There's not too much showing up on the radar at the moment, a little bit on the Ceduna radar and the odd very light shower over the far south of the pastoral district. Still a little bit about the Fleurieu Peninsula and the lower southeast district. So they're fairly isolated and fairly light. And I think as we continue through this afternoon, we'll see those showers pretty much clear, so that by this evening should be dry conditions right across the state, I think, and probably start to see some of that cloud break up a little bit as well. Over the weekend, the high pressure system, which is currently centred well south of the Bight, that high will move slowly eastwards across waters south of South Australia, and as it does that, will bring mostly clear skies to South Australia, maybe a little bit of cloud about sort of southern coasts, but generally right across SA we'll see mostly sunny days for Saturday, Sunday and even for Monday. By Monday I think that high will be out over the Tasman Sea, so we'll see our winds go round a little bit more northeasterly. They won't be terribly strong, but enough northeasterly to sort of bring some warmer conditions to most districts. So temperatures, maximum temperatures staying below average for today and Saturday, near average for Sunday, and then with that, those warmer conditions on Monday, we'll see a warmer day on Monday. However, the nights will be cold under the influence of that high pressure ridge as it moves across. I think tomorrow morning will be a little bit on the cold side, but Sunday and Monday mornings likely to be a bit colder. Particularly over parts of the agricultural area where we'll see minimum temperatures well below average for this time of year. So I think some spots seeing minimum temperatures down into the low single digits. So a couple of cold nights on the way, likely to see a bit of patchy fog and a little bit of patchy frost around the place as well on those two mornings in particular. On Tuesday, another front approaching from the west, so we'll see the warm conditions continue on Tuesday ahead of that change and then becoming cooler again with some showers moving across, mostly sort of developing near western and southern coasts on Tuesday and continuing about western and southern coasts Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, maybe pushing up a little bit further inland over southern agricultural areas at times with the movement of that front. But what that means is that rainfall totals for the next few days pretty low, with Saturday, Sunday, Monday and most of Tuesday being pretty well dry and the showers today pretty much clearing during the afternoon. So any rainfall totals during that four-day period out to the end of Tuesday likely to be on the low side, and we'd struggle to see much more than 1 or 2 millimetres anywhere, I think, Selena.
All right, well, I'll be popping an extra blanket on the bed, I think, for the next few nights.
I think that's a very good idea. Get the hot water bottle out, Selena.
All right, I will. Thanks, Simon. Enjoy the rest of your Friday.
Thanks, Selena.
Simon Timke there from the Weather Bureau. Now, the forecast for the western inland parts of New South Wales, the upper western district looking at a partly cloudy day tomorrow, sunny for the lower western, southerly winds for the upper western district around 15 to 25 k's an hour, turning southeasterlies 25 to 40 k's an hour in the late morning. For the lower western district, south to southeasterly winds around 25 to 35 k's an hour, becoming light in the late evening. Both districts expecting overnight temperatures to drop to around 10 degrees, with daytime temps in the low to mid 20s. We're going to talk wool in this next half an hour. Is it on trend? Is it in fashion? What does that mean for the Australian wool industry?
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green.
Hi, great to have your company on this Friday. Let's talk wool today. Do you buy a lot of woolen clothing? Is it something that you seek out? Are you happy to fork out a bit more for wool because you see the value in it, the longevity? Or is wool that's something out of your price range? I'd like to get a bit of an idea on how you feel about buying wool products today. Let me know on my talkback number, 1300 222 891. Do you find it lasts? The text line, 0467 922 891. Fast fashion and tightening budgets means the world is buying less Australian wool. So has it fallen out of fashion? We'll talk about that, and you'll actually hear what one famous fashion designer has to say. And do you have any idea how long an octopus can live, and why on earth would you need to?
We analyse certain tissues in the body, like the beak, which is the mouth part of the octopus, which is hard like a bird beak. And within that beak, there are growth rings, a bit like a tree.
Yeah, it turns out octopuses, they're a bit punk rock. They live fast, die young. More on ageing octopus soon. Before I get to that, though, let's get to news headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, Showdown train commuters are facing major disruptions next month, with drivers planning to take 24-hour strike action on May the 2nd. The Rail, Tram and Bus Union says the threat is designed to force the private operator, Keolis Downer, to improve its pay offer. Workers have been demanding a 20% pay increase over 4 years. The Department of Transport is investigating whether the opening times for the Tom Diver Derrick Bridge at Port Adelaide should be changed. There were major peak hour traffic disruptions yesterday when a mechanical failure just after 6 a.m. caused the bridge to become stuck open. And a drink driver has been arrested after crashing his car into bushes and fleeing the scene at Otway overnight. Police were called to Grand Junction Road after a Nissan hatchback lost control at the corner of Glenroy Street. A witness provided patrols with a description of the driver, which led them to a 38-year-old man who had the keys to the crash car. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with headlines. Well, off the back of this week's Senate inquiry into major supermarket practices, the National Farmers Federation has called for the voluntary food and grocery code to be made mandatory and for it to also include Bunnings. Bunnings has argued that the code was designed for supermarkets and was not fit for purpose for retailers like it. Here's some of what Joylan Burnett from the National Farmers Federation had to say on the program yesterday.
Oh, look, we think it should undoubtedly be applied to Bunnings. We do accept that there may be some modifications, some alterations required. Yeah, I would accept Bunnings' point that there are some differences, but not sufficient to warrant not including them in the code. Their behaviour is so similar to the behaviour of Coles and Woolworths. That it's very clear they need to be regulated under a similar framework.
So that's what the National Farmers Federation has to say. We've since received this statement in response from Bunnings Managing Director Mike Schneider, which reads, I'll read it in full, "We acknowledge the independent review of the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct Interim Report and note its assessment that the code has been designed specifically for the supermarket sector. We also note its assessment that extending it to other industries may create unintended consequences." Statement goes on to say the characteristics of the industry sector that Bunnings is part of is both diverse and structurally different to many other sectors, including pharmacy, supermarket and others. Because of this diversity, it would make the application of such a code quite difficult to apply, particularly given our commercial offer and exposure to the building and construction industry. Bunnings says we're proud to offer a broad range of home improvement and lifestyle products and services to millions of retail and commercial customers across Australia Our relationship with our suppliers is critical to the success of our business, and we actively engage in a number of ways, including supplier forums and surveys. The statement goes on to say, we have processes and trading agreements in place to ensure those relationships are fair and transparent. We also have a range of avenues available for suppliers to raise concerns with us, including our anonymous and secure independent reporting service. And this statement wraps up by saying, like any organisation, we don't get it right every time, but we work incredibly hard to build long-standing win-win relationships with our suppliers. And that statement has come from Bunnings Managing Director Mike Schneider. You're with Selena Green on the South Australian Country Hour. It is just going on 25 minutes to one. Well, picture a shearer sweating away, working away in the shearing shed, clippers in hand, with a woolly sheep. That's an iconic Australian image, right? But times are changing. Shearers are in shorter supply across the country, and the industry is looking at new, improved ways of getting that valuable wool off the sheep's back. Bioharvesting is one of the potential answers. And researchers who've spent decades coming up with a better bioharvesting method for wool say they're almost to the point of getting it commercially viable. The process will give wool producers an alternative to traditional shearing by creating a weak point in the wool fibre, which allows for mechanical harvesting. How soon could this be ready to be used, and how much is it going to cost? Well, the University of Adelaide Professor Phil Hind has been heading up this research, and he gave an update at this week's International Wool Textile Organisation Congress in Adelaide.
We've been researching the idea of bioharvesting for about 15 to 20 years now, and we've made some progress along the way, but just recently, in the last 2 years, we made a very significant breakthrough, which has made it, you know, potentially commercially viable now.
So what is this breakthrough? Has this been in the administration or the efficacy of this method?
Yeah, mainly what it was we've identified a target. It's kind of a biochemical target that operates in the follicle, which produces the fibre, the wool fibre. And once we identified that target, which if you hit the target with the right bullet, it makes the wool weak, which means it doesn't harden properly. You know, wool and hair starts off soft and squishy like all cells in your body, but a hardening process makes it turn into the dead thing we've got on our head. And that's the process we've worked out, and we've worked out which bullet to use.
What's it taken to get to this point?
A lot of work. apart from that, we had to do a lot of pretty clever science to work out just how we might be able to make wool weak enough that we could break it just by combing, but not so weak that it would fall out in the field, because that would remove the whole idea. Mm. We want it to be weak enough that we can break it easily with a comb or a combing type machine, but really sufficiently strong that it won't come off in the paddock. And we proved the whole thing about 2 years ago, so we can make it weak. It stays on the paddock. It protects the sheep from sunburn and cold, and we know we can remove it with simple mechanical devices.
Right, so it's the not too hot, not too cold, the just right method that
Correct.
You've been trying to get to it, and you reckon you've got there.
Yeah, it's the Goldilocks solution. That's right.
So what happens from here now that you've sort of reached this point where, you know, you've got to where you're hoping to be with the method? What happens then next?
So what we have to do is we've got to do a lot of the hard work of getting, it's a naturally occurring chemical, it's a naturally occurring protein we're using. We can extract it from plants. So that's a good thing. It's natural. Organic type compound. We've got to get that compound accredited for this use through regulations. So APVMA chemical approval has to be reached. So we've got to do a lot of clinical trials in sheep right across the country. We've got to prove that it works in all sheep types, in all environments, and that it doesn't cause any health problems to the animal.
So quite a few hurdles still to overcome.
Yep.
Realistically, what do you see as a time frame? Can you put a time frame on when this might be something widespread in use out in the paddocks?
Yep, we've got a time frame because everything in this project is so critical. We've got to get this to work because the industry is quite desperate to overcome the shearer shortage. And so we're on a very tight deadline to make sure that we can deliver it. Our aim is to have it ready for on-farm use by the end of 28.
And as you say, I mean, obviously an urgent need for this from an industry perspective around lack of shearing, but is there an animal welfare aspect to this as well that is driving a bit of this?
The whole thing's a win-win-win. It's better for the sheep because the sheep is not handled by a shearer. It's not cut by the combs and cutters. There's none of the stress that's involved in current shearing because the animal is basically not handled by people. It goes onto a conveyor belt that moves it along past the machine, which combs the wool off, and the sheep jumps off the other end with just a nice covering left. So it's better for the sheep. It's better for the quality of the product because there's no, you know, sheep get cut a lot during shearing and those skin bits end up in the wool fleece. There's no second cuts, which means the fibres are all uniform length and that makes for better quality. And the ends of the fibre are finer, which will make for better comfort fabric. So everything about it is a win. We've just got to make it cheap enough and able to work under the harsh conditions of all farms in Australia.
Obviously, you know, having that evidence that it does work is really important to bringing producers on board. But I'm interested to know, because you presented about this at the conference in Adelaide this week, as well as obviously, you know, you've got producers on board perhaps as part of trials. Hey, what kind of reaction and response and do you get from industry? Is this going to be a hard sell, do you think, to get producers using it?
No. My phone rings hot all week. I get rung probably 20 times a week by producers from all over the country saying, when's it going to be ready? There'll be no need if this works and it's cheap enough, they'll take it up. Even the meat breed people are talking to me. They have wool that's not even worth the cost of shearing. And if our product, and we've shown that it works in crossbreeds and composite breeds, if it works in those, we'll be able to leave those sheep without removing the wool because it will gradually fall off in the paddock if you leave it for long enough. That frees up shearers from shearing meat sheep and they can concentrate on wool sheep.
Cost, a big issue. What sort of ballpark figure are we talking?
The good thing about the product that we're using at the moment is that it's very cheap to extract from plants and you can do that at scale. So we basically can remove a lot of the product with a simple water wash and then a clean-up of the product. So I think the chemical will be relatively cheap. And I mean probably guessing under $1 a sheep. Then the mechanical system, that's more difficult because it'll depend on the engineers that are working on this have different ideas about how to remove it and they're trialling those at the moment. So it'll depend on whether farmers own their own machine or whether there's a contract that goes around with the machine. That's still to be worked out.
And I should point out that that is a separate part of the research or separate research going on to the mechanical removal of then this fleece sort of once it gets to that point to come off.
Yeah, there's three groups in Australia that are working on the mechanical engineering part. So those two parts have to work together for it all to work.
That's Professor Phil Hind. He's at the University of Adelaide and he has been leading that research. It is 17 minutes to one.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Selena Green bringing you the Country Hour today. Well, let's stick with wool for now because when we talk about trends, of course, they come and go, but what about wool? Do people still want to wear it? Australian wool production has been on a decline as consumers tighten their belts and turn to cheaper fast fashion. Peter Aykroyd is the Global Strategic Advisor for the Woolmark Company. He's also the COO of Campaign for Wool. He's also the chair of the International Wool Textile Organisation's Retail Forum, as we heard their meeting in Adelaide for their Congress this week. I had a chance to speak with Peter and I asked him if globally wool was still on trend.
Yes, what I would highlight on that is wool is on trend for women's wear at the moment, and particularly women's tailored wear, which is very refreshing as it hasn't been on trend for quite some time. I'm seeing quite a bit of women's tailored trousers, tailored jackets being showcased in Europe, particularly in the UK, and even in spring, which is obviously it's our spring at the moment. So I think autumn could be quite a promising season. This, of course, Selena, is in the context of quite a few headwinds against consumer spending at the moment, which we have to deal with. But certainly wool is very much on trend, and I would highlight the women's wear trend as probably one of the major ones to emerge.
As we're hearing a lot about a cost of living crisis, not certainly just here in Australia, but that is around the world. Is wool pretty resilient when, you know, times get tough that consumers still want to wear and buy wool?
Well, I've always quoted Vivian Westwood on this, who said, buy well, buy little, buy wool. One hopes that this is a trend that is something which makes wool an investment with what I call a return on capital invested. Because if you do buy wool instead of polyester or cotton, wool will last. And I think the whole look of fashion now is not to be changing everything every 6 weeks or every 6 months. Fashion is about a bit of longevity, and wool can give longevity. So I'm relatively optimistic, but given that, I'm not unaware of the problems that consumers are putting their hands in their pockets and not getting the money out, unfortunately.
Mm. I mean, of course, we've seen the rise of, you know, these fast fashion websites where people can order things in and wear them once and we'll throw them away because they are so cheap to come in. Are we also seeing, though, a growing backlash to a lot of that as well? So is there an opportunity for wool here to really sell itself as the opposite, as the more environmentally friendly and responsible answer to that fast fashion?
I think that is the key question at the moment. Retail in the UK is quite polarised. Fashion, I think, in my view, is quite polarised as well. There is fast fashion, which is totally unsustainable, non-biodegradable, everything evil that you can imagine about over-consumer spending. And I think some of the British retailers, from where I come, of course, and Marks and Spencer's next, Charles Tewitt, are very, very active in trading up and getting a better quality product into store, particularly Marks and Spencer's, who wool has known since Marks and Spencer started in Leeds, where I was born in 1884. You know, so we are seeing some trading up. We're seeing product being improved via more natural fibres. So let's hope that this will help the demand curve for wool from Australia. I'm optimistic on that.
Obviously, Australian wool growers would be keen to hear that optimism. But is this good news for Australian? I mean, is Australian wool particularly in demand? Does it matter where it's coming from?
I think, as we are in Australia, we produce 80% of apparel wool. You know, axiomatically, it's got to be in the interests of wool growers if you get wool into ladies' tailored wear in Marks and Spencer's and in the British and German retail high street. It is very good. I mean, even though it could be sometimes in blend form, at least it is bulk, it is quantity, and we need quantity. So I'm pretty happy about it. And I also think knitwear is doing relatively well, not as well as it did last season, but let's see what happens in winter. There's some very good campaign for wool and Woolmark campaigns in London with Charles Tewitt on We Know Merino, which is an excellent campaign for knitwear. But of course, the supply chain is quite obvious. The merino comes from here, goes to China, spun into yarn, and is knitted up and sent into UK retail. And it's a very competitive market. Mm. But wool was very, very present there, very present.
Yeah. I mean, once upon a time, consumers might have only asked, you know, is it wool or what percentage of wool is in this product? Is it more these days also, well, how sustainable, how ethical is this wool that I'm wearing?
Yes, I think the question that it's sustainable is fine. That's not a question with any doubt. People realise that wool is natural and biodegradable. Obviously, there are some products which are obviously blended with polyester, which is unfortunate, but we're going to have to live with that. I'd rather be 51% wool and 49% polyester than 100% polyester. It's a trend which I think if we start to see blends coming in, then that blending will lead to a pure product, I hope.
As Peter Aykroyd, he's the Global Strategic Advisor for the Woolmark Company and Chief Operating Officer for the Campaign for Wool. On the text line, Maggie says, wool is one of the best fabrics ever. Long may it stay that way. Gail, also on the text line, says, wool is lovely but expensive. We need to be able to throw things in the washing machine without them losing shape. Synthetics can be better for this, says Gail. And talking about bioharvesting of wool, Wally is a wool grower from the West Coast, not a fan. His text says, was a dumb idea 10 years ago. Still dumb, reckons Wally. Well, as I mentioned, Peter Aykroyd was in Adelaide for the International Wool Textile Organisations Conference. Well, also there is Australian-American fashion designer Dion Lee. Now, he studied fashion at TAFE. He's since shown collections of his Dion Lee label at the Australian, New York and London Fashion Weeks, and his designs have been worn by the Duchess of Sussex, Meghan Markle, and pop royalty, Taylor Swift. He was part of a retail forum discussing how social media impacts consumer trends, and I had a chance to speak with Dion about how much wool has featured in his work over the years.
Since the start of my fashion career, I have been working with wool and really working with tailoring. The first few years of really starting my brand, and even dating back to college and my graduate collection. While I was in college, I was doing an internship with a tailor in Sydney, and it kind of developed from there, a mixture of both men's and women's wear. And now we offer both men's and women's wear under the brand. I think when I was a little more established, I started working with Merino knitwear, and knitwear became a really big growth category for us. So yeah, I've been working with Woolmark for years now, so it's really nice to be back in Adelaide and understanding more about the industry and the landscape that the farmers are experiencing.
Mm. I guess it is really one of those products that, well, materials that when you're working with, it does have that provenance, so that story that it goes back to the farmer. Is that something that you think in any way appeals to the average consumer when they are picking up or choosing something that is made of wool?
I think the consciousness of natural fibre and the sustainability aspect of working with a natural fibre as opposed to a man-made fabric, I think is more important to the consumer now than it ever has been. We are trying to communicate that value into the product, and both in how we kind of communicate online, on social media, within our e-commerce, and also passing on that message to our wholesalers. So, yeah, I think it is more important now more than ever for people to really understand the true quality of wool and for that to be reflected in the product.
And it's going to social media, obviously, back in my day, even aging myself, you know, if you wanted to see what was in fashion and what was, you know, going on in the world, you had to go buy yourself a copy of Vogue or get your fashion magazines. Obviously, these days, there's so much available on social media. Can you overstate the impact that social media and the influence that it has on consumer trends?
It's extremely powerful and can be something that designers can really harness to communicate the value of the product. Yeah, I think we being an international brand and having a presence in the US and being able to communicate to our customer within our Australian retail business, social media has really made that possible, bridging different time zones and really opening the conversation with a global customer.
Now, one of your designs, for example, was worn by, you know, one of the biggest pop stars in the world, Taylor Swift, at the Super Bowl. I mean, it doesn't get much bigger than that. And I think what that particular item was sold out very, very quickly as a result. Do you think wool has a potential, or wool growers and the wool industry should be harnessing that kind of power that social media has to tell the story of wool?
It's an incredible tool to really reach a broader audience, but a very challenging thing to harness. Unfortunately, often the celebrity really does need to choose the product, and it's hard to influence them to really work with anything specific. But yeah, more and more, we see the merino wool or tailoring becoming a bigger part of the collection, and the support of those silhouettes on celebrity in their day-to-day life or even on the red carpet is something that we're seeing a really big pickup on.
Do you think consumers really want wool these days, especially in that higher-end market? Is that something that they're seeking out at the moment?
I definitely think that the quality of the fabrication of wool has always been something that is visible in a product, and I think now more than ever the customer is looking for, at my end of the market, the sophistication of the product and the quality. So in that regard, I definitely think they are looking for wool and appreciating the performance and longevity of the fabric.
Australian-American fashion designer Dion Lee speaking there. 6 minutes to one. Well, how do you figure out how old an octopus is? And why on earth would you want or need to? Well, Australia's octopus fisheries are being trained in how to age an octopus. A new octopus survival guide has been released by the University of South Australia to make sure any fishing of the species remains sustainable. Co-author of the guide and UniSA marine ecologist, Dr. Zoe Doubleday, says understanding how old an octopus is hasn't been easy to figure out.
This was a collaborative work produced by a team of scientists. And what really prompted us was there's a lot of practical knowledge held in the heads of scientists and researchers, practical laboratory methods. And this particular practical knowledge is how to age an octopus species. And you might wonder why on earth we want to do that. And it's because if we know the age of the animal, whether it's 6 months old or 1 year old, it is crucial data that is fed into the management of fisheries. And so it helps ensure that fisheries are sustainable. And so what we wanted to do was make sure all those methods about how to age octopus is written down in a step-by-step guide, because that is usually lost to science and to the world.
So how long do octopi live?
So they're short-lived. Most people would be surprised that they might only live 1 or 2 years. There's some exceptions to that rule, like some of the deep-sea species can live a few years. But generally, the sort of everyday coastal octopus that people encounter are short-lived, and they many species die after breeding, so that's why they have that short life.
And so how are the octopus kind of levels around Australia at the moment? Are there enough of them about?
Yes, Australia's got a number of different species. The fisheries are very small compared to some of the other fisheries around the world, and it's sort of a boutique industry in other countries in the world. Octopus is sort of in countries like Spain, octopus is a staple part of the diet. So in Australia, you know, I don't think we have, you know, any much to worry about in terms of octopus levels.
Right, so how will this guide interact with local fisheries then?
Yeah, so this guide actually originally started because we were working with some researchers in New South Wales who were working with developing the New South Wales octopus fishery, and they wanted some more advice about developing aging methods for their particular species. So there's actually lots of different octopus species, and how you age them depending, the methods vary depending what species they are. So it does have direct relevance to our local fisheries, and we've also developed aging methods for one of our local species in South Australia as well.
How difficult is it to actually determine an octopus age logistically for people using this guide? What are they looking out for?
Yeah, so you need a lab, but it's not that. You don't need too much sophisticated equipment, but it's quite time consuming. So what we do is we analyse certain tissues in the body, like the beak, which is the mouth part of the octopus, which is hard like a bird beak. And within that beak, there are growth rings, a bit like a tree. But because octopus are sort of fast growing, die young, live fast, their growth bands are daily as opposed to like annual like a tree. And so there's a lot of rings to count. So even if the animal's only 18 months old, you can understand that's a lot of rings someone needs to count to age the octopus.
Do we know enough about our range of octopuses in Australia?
I'd say no. I think generally there's so much we don't know compared to, say, what we know about many of the more common fish species. I think octopus are more under the radar. And in, you know, in fisheries, you know, they might not even be defined by species. They might just be called octopus. But there's lots of different species out there, and they're very different. So it's actually really crucial to know what species you're working with. And sometimes species are really poorly defined in Australia, so there's probably a lot more species out there, but we just don't know about them. They haven't been discovered yet.
That's UniSA marine ecologist Dr. Zoe Doubleday speaking with Elsie Adama. And thank you very much to Mandy at Seton, who recommended the My Octopus Teacher doco. Go check it out if you haven't. It's fantastic. Nikolai Bailhartz, hello.
Hello. A couple of different things that we'll be talking about this afternoon on the driving front and on the roads front. There's been a couple of changes that I think are worth discussing. There's or looks like there could be this change to if you're going past a mechanic's vehicle, someone that's helping someone that's broken down, you may soon have to slow down to 25 kilometres an hour. So we'll find out why that change has been proposed. And those new cameras that can detect people using mobile phones are now officially have been switched onto the testing phase, so they're one step closer to actually pinging you, and you can cop a pretty big fine. So we'll talk about that too.
All right, we'll be on the road with Nikolai Bellhartz for this afternoon's program. Thanks so much for your company today and throughout the week. I'll be back on Monday with more Country Hour. The time is just going on to 1 o'clock, and it's time for the news.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon, and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.